Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. For the present, my answers are posted every other week on Mondays, and Dr. Yaron Brook answers questions on current events on the alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off at the end, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Is it exalting the primitive to enjoy ethnic food from primitive cultures, such as traditional Mexican and Thai restaurants? No, certainly not. You are not making a philosophic assessment if you enjoy food from Mexico or Thai or any other place as far as that's concerned. You are enjoying this primarily. This is a perceptual enjoyment. This is what the food tastes like or looks like. And there's nothing in enjoying that that implies you agree with the philosophy of Mexico or the politics of Mexico. I used to love Chipotle, for instance, which is a Mexican restaurant. I stopped going in protest when they stopped serving carnitas, you know, which is pork, which they did basically on ecological grounds. But the food as such, I thought was excellent. There are many foods, Russian food, for instance. Well, I was brought up on Russian food. Well, I love Russian food, but I sure as hell would not therefore imply that I approve or exalt, you know, Russian history or Russian politics or Russian mysticism. So long as the pleasures you enjoy are not the philosophic essence of that society, but some perceptual element on the surface, which doesn't bring its mysticism or whatever with it. For instance, dance. You may love a Spanish dance or a French ballet and Brazilian, forget what it's called, one of those South American, cha-cha, one of those countries. Anyway, that's, you're enjoying the movement, the feeling, the appearance, the clothing. You enjoy the Viennese waltz. That's not because, you know, you have anything in favor of Viennese society. You may know nothing about Austria. And the same for clothes. You can enjoy clothes that are distinctive to a given culture and you think look good on you. The problem of exalting the primitive would only be if you think that because you like these perceptual offshoots, you are implying an endorsement of the philosophic nature of the society. And that is wrong. In fact, just tell you an interesting observation that Ayn Rand made once. Someone said to her, isn't it funny that Russian and Czechoslovakian Polish food is so good, and then German and French food compared to English and American food? That it seemed to her, or seemed to the person, that the more civilized and the better the premises of a country, the worse the quality of its food, the taste. And she said, no, she said, I think that's very obvious. These poorer countries get poorer cuts of meat or less, and therefore they have to dress it up, and therefore they have to come up with all these, you know, cream sauces and butter sauces and all the rest of it, so that even though the meat is not that good, the meal is really good. Whereas the British and Americans are rich enough to get the top cuts of everything. So they can eat it as it is with maybe, you know, a little Worcester sauce or salt. They don't have to disguise or enhance it. So if you like, you know, Russian food, that's fine. But it doesn't prove that you are approving of the culture. And the same way, if people say, oh, I can't take another hamburger, American food is not as good as French. I agree. I don't think American food is as good as French. But that doesn't mean I prefer to live in France, because there's more to life than, you know, bread and hamburgers. Another question. Can you be a very emotional person? Now, I stopped the question right there and asked, and a very emotional person, do you mean a rational person who has very strong values, but he knows what they are, where they come from, when it's appropriate to act on them? Or do you mean someone who has very strong values and emotions, but no idea where they come from or when it's appropriate to act on them? So he is in practice a whim worshiper. He does, but he does violently because he's very emotional, whatever he feels like. So the question is, can you be very emotional and a very emotional person and still be an objectivist? It entirely depends which one he is. A whim worshiper? No. But very emotional, Ayn Rand was as emotional as you will get if you define it a certain way. She had the capacity for a very strong joy, love, rage, anger. She was absolutely the opposite of being, you know, subdued or repressed or quiet. So in that sense, absolutely. Now, the questioner goes on, many of the objectivist intellectuals I've listened to, with the exception of Jerome Brock, you don't include me, so I assume I'm not part of the exception, but that's okay. The objectivists, other than Jerome Brock, are extremely robotic and cold, and they appear to have no personality at all. Well, how do you judge whether somebody is cold and have no personality at all if all he's doing is answering questions to the public? Having a sense of humor doesn't prove anything necessarily about his personality. That's something that can be easily learned. Impersonating, an image that the audience wants. I'm not saying Jerome does this, but I'm simply saying you can't judge from what you see unless it's a close person. You see what they really are. And I think it really, to me, what that question means, now maybe I'm being paranoid, but to me the question means, if you agree consistently with everything Ayn Rand said, you don't disagree with anything, and you're calm in the face of hostility, then you're robotic and cold. It means that, and this is not necessarily this questioner, but is often a way of, the question all the time, do you have ideas that she hated? Do you have any individuality, or you just go along with the litany, haters, hey, and there is a reality? Well, if you know anything about philosophy, of course you have to go along with the, quote, litany. There's many room for options, but not in regard to the fundamentals of philosophy. And then he concludes this question, can you be an objectivist and still scream? Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of reasons to scream. Your team in baseball wins, or you're having a really great sexual experience. That can certainly be followed by a scream or more. Or you get, fabulous news. Your daughter graduated and won the lottery, $100 million for life. I mean, there are many things which are so good, not necessarily expected, that the only way to express your feeling is to scream. Now, you cite horse races. Yes, I have screamed at a horse race, especially if I put some money on it and I picked out a horse out of the program by diligent study, not that I know how to do it, and it turns out to win, I have screamed, absolutely. I've come home, horse from a horse race, H-O-A and H-O-R. Now, I don't do that very often, but I have. Now, but here I draw the line. He says, what about if you scream and yell at cage fights? Now, that I say absolutely no. If by cage fights, you mean you take two animals, like two dogs or chicken, and you put them in and they're given the task to kill each other, it gets repulsive and disgusting. I don't know any way to make it against the law, but to take these innocent creatures, a horse race, you're testing skill, and you reward the horse at the end. But even you're taking chance, okay, but to take two innocent animals and just pit them against each other to see how much, who is going to kill which one first, I cannot believe that that can be watched innocently. I might be overgeneralizing. I would never go to one like that. I'm getting more extreme on this issue than I have been earlier. If I'm reading a novel, even a decent novel, and like halfway through, the house's, the family's pet dog gets run over, that's it. I close the book, I don't care what happens. So, but that may, I'm sure, is optional, but I don't think anybody could defend the idea of deliberate, prolonged torture proposed by... I heard of a man recently who killed a lion, somewhere in Africa. And instead of killing, the story I heard, they wounded the lion, so it lived 40 hours in that kind of agony, and then they killed it. And they got some kind of better hide or better mane. I don't know what it is they did. I think that's awful. If you're going to kill for sport even, then you should kill immediately. But to subject animals to prolonged misery, what kind of person would get what kind of enjoyment from behavior like that? It absolutely revolts me. I heard a question. Why, if Alexander the Great was taught by Aristotle, did he become such a world conqueror? The implication is that a teacher is omnipotent. So if you have a great teacher, the student is going to be great. It doesn't follow. It absolutely doesn't follow. Ayn Rand has had some students who are really wicked, or who were when they were alive. It doesn't follow. Sometimes what the teacher teaches is taken to heart, sometimes not. But what you can see, and Ayn Rand even commented on this once to me, Alexander the Great, which of course not admirable as a world conqueror, but she said it's interesting that Aristotle, the teacher of integration on a wide scale, had a student who, if he was going to be a conqueror, wanted to conquer the whole world and make it one unit. Whereas today, if you take the kind of teachings that you get all the Kantian disintegration, nihilism, and then look at the generals that you get, you don't get anybody trying to put everything together. They're saying, should we defend this province of Iraq today or let it go tomorrow until... There's no general of any value because there's no philosopher of any value. So Douglas MacArthur is probably, to my knowledge, the last American general who deserves the name. Now, I'm sure you're all going to come up with others. Patton, I know, was good, but I don't know all of them. But I know MacArthur was great. Who his teacher was, I don't know. What is the meaning behind the numbers associated with the names in Anthem? I think you are the only one who might know. Oh, no, that's not true. Anybody my age knows, but it's a way of using the telephone. It is gone. In the old days, before there was area code, cities or geographic areas were each given a name. Like for the New York City, there was a section called Murray Hill, a section called Oregon, a section called Butterfield. And the way numbers were assigned, you took the first two letters of the name and then you added five numbers. So for instance, Ayn Rand's number, I don't mind giving it to you now because it doesn't answer. Ayn Rand's number was Murray Hill. So you dialed MU, and then 54843. MU 54843. Of course, everybody, when she wrote this way back in the 30s, knew altogether what it was. It was just taking that mechanism from the telephone. And, you know, I think it's cute, but it's certainly not original with her. John O'Hara had a book called Butterfield 8. I think they made a movie with Elizabeth Taylor. And that was one of the New York, I think it was New York codes. And, you know, they were easier to remember because you only had five digits to remember instead of seven, and now three is 10. But, you know, the system expanded. I guess they couldn't keep it. That's all there is to those numbers.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.